Wednesday night of March 23rd was the longest night of Steve Fulcher's life, waiting for a break that might lead police to the missing 22-year-old Sian O'Callaghan. Under the guise of collecting DNA samples from all local taxi drivers, the police had collected a sample from their prime suspect, Christopher Halliwell. He had given police an alibi that they knew from CCTV wasn't true. That afternoon, as the sun set, Halliwell returned to his house and had not come out again. Even after his partner Heather went out to her evening job, Halliwell stayed exactly where he was, and all the surveillance team could see was the outside of his house. As Steve Fulcher explains, the tense wait for the police carried another risk.
The Wednesday night is the important piece because he was surveilled to Heathrow Airport. The officers overheard him saying specific things. They'd obviously got very, very close. He drove home into his home address. Heather went out to work for that night, and he's alone in darkness in this house. I've got the house under surveillance, and of course I'm pacing the floor thinking, well, if he's committed suicide, this is the worst of all possible scenarios. I mean, he's under my duty of care on the one hand, only he knows where Sian is. What if she's inside the house and I don't take the option to act on that? That presents its own issues. Most of that night was taken up with trying to get an intercept on his phone, and that went all the way up to the chief constable.
On one hand, the suspect might be feeling cornered and suicidal after the police showed up at his work. But on the other hand, with his partner at work, Halliwell might leave the house any moment and head for the forest. Steve's request to tap Halliwell's phone came to nothing, leaving him with an agonising wait for information.
Spring Gardens, who run this facility, would be required to get the Home Secretary, Theresa May, out of bed to sign the warrant. They weren't prepared to do that. And I was saying, well, if he commits suicide, makes a last call to his daughter or Heather or whoever, say, I'm going to top myself for whatever reason, I'm missing the vital and only source of intelligence or information as to where Sian is. So if there is ever a circumstance under which that facility should be put in place, it's clearly now. So I spent most of that night concerned that he was hanging from a rafter, and I've had cases that where that precise thing has happened, and obviously extremely concerned for his welfare. But knowing that if I intervened preemptively, it was the end of any notion of finding Sian. So that was the story of the Wednesday night. Fortunately, he got up at 6 a.m. and took a taxi fare, and I thought, well, it's back game on again. We'll have to keep going and hoping that something changes this paradigm.
One way or another, the deadline was fast approaching, and Steve knew this was going to be the day that saw Halliwell arrested. He'd made that decision with his boss the day before. But what he didn't know was how soon it would happen. In the end, his worst fears came incredibly close to being realised.
I'd been pacing the floor. I mean, obviously I hadn't slept during that Wednesday night. The phone call came in, I think, around 10 a.m. from the surveillance commander, making this point that they'd observed him buying this overdose quantity of pills, as they described it. And I suppose once professional response kicks in, it becomes very clear. The decision-making was very, very clear. Prior to that point, I was desperately racking my brains and talking to people, trying to find alternative operational choices
available to me, and I couldn't find any. There were none, as far as I could see. We tried every tactic in terms of covert tactics, undercover officer deployment. We tried speaking to him directly. We tried using the media in a very, very bold strategy. And nothing had apparently prompted a response from Halliwell that would indicate where Sean O'Callaghan was.
The minute Halliwell bought an overdose quantity of pills, the game was effectively over. The police could no longer wait to bring him in.
So, because you've got to bear in mind, from my perspective, the enormous tension when you don't know. And that was largely brought to a head when the report came in that he'd bought this overdose quantity of pills. Then the decision was taken out of my hands. There's no question at that point what you need to do next. You clearly can't allow him to commit suicide whilst under surveillance, because he's under my duty of care. And for the same reasons that if he was responsible for the abduction of Sean O'Callaghan, she would die as a consequence. So in some ways, that then forced all the issues that followed. Prior to that point, I was in a state of such lack of knowledge as to whether I'd got the right man, as to whether we were following the right tactics, trying to find alternative tactics, hoping that some additional piece of information, maybe a witness would come forward or some piece of information would come to hand that would change the equation, that would make it clear that he's the right offender, make it clear what he's actually done.
5 days on from the abduction of Sean O'Callaghan, Steve arrested Chris Halliwell on suspicion of her abduction. And like so many police interactions in the smartphone age, it would happen in the full glare of social media, as Sean's mother, Elaine, recalls.
I can remember it kind of almost happening simultaneously. There were things going out on the television at more or less the same time we were being told things, because I believe I've since learned that I think it was Sky News had a helicopter in the area. And I think it was actually for something else, but they'd picked up on something was going on. The liaisons were trying to keep us up to speed ahead of what was going on the television, basically, so that we'd find out from them rather than seeing on the television. And then, we got told, I don't know again exact times, I would say it was between 11 and 12 on the Thursday morning, that they had made an arrest outside an Asda supermarket. But of course, they're telling us, and within seconds, it's on the TV, because an arrest at a supermarket, you'd imagine, with social media and phones, it was more or less all happening at the same time on the television and in the room.
Steve Fulcher was in much the same position as the family. He too was watching it play out via film footage.
There was what seemed to me like an enormous gap of time in which no information was coming my way, but they were manoeuvring him into a suitable place, I think at Asda's in Swindon, where they could effect the arrest safely. Now, the arrest was filmed by members of the public on their camera and was in the hands of the media before it actually came to me, funnily enough. As you can't do anything. But the whole town, of course, was engaged in this case and up in arms, so you kind of understand it. So the first contact, as I was trying to consider what to do next, came from the Sun newspaper via our media office saying, have you got a quote as to why this individual has been arrested? And that just illustrates the difficulty of working with the media on a crime in action. It is a bit like catching a tiger by the tail. You know, obviously, they've got their job to do, but I'm trying to do something very, very complex and difficult.
But the intense publicity was far from the only unusual aspect of this case. For other reasons too, this would be a very different kind of arrest. In routine circumstances, when someone is arrested, what happens is that they are read their rights, or cautioned, as they say in the UK, then taken immediately to the police station, where they are given access to a solicitor before any questioning begins. This is all governed by strict rules. In the UK, these are set out in something called PACE, the Police and Criminal Evidence Act of 1984. BBC journalist Steve Brodie explains why the PACE rules are so strict.
There are quite strict rules about how police officers deal with suspects. They're governed by what's known as the PACE laws. They were brought in following the verbaling up of suspects. That means policemen putting words into people's mouths and generally making sure they're guilty before they've even reached a trial. They were brought in mainly because of activities of the Metropolitan Police and others in the 1960s, and people thought they were unsound convictions because of this ability to put words into people's mouths. Under the PACE laws, when somebody has been arrested, they're cautioned, they're taken back to a police station, and they're given access to a lawyer. Fundamentally, that's what the PACE laws are about. There is no room for discussion, with the possible exception of under a kidnap situation where a police officer thinks that he can save someone's life.
Of course, these were not routine circumstances, and Halliwell was not going to be taken immediately to the police station. Steve had already decided on a different and rare course of action. Halliwell was going to be questioned right away, without a solicitor, using an option under the rules called an urgent interview.
During the course of the Wednesday night, I'd already preempted the notion of having to conduct an urgent interview in discussion with my interview advisor, and we devised an interview strategy for a pair of advanced interview officers in the event that he had to be arrested prior to Sian being found. Perfectly properly, very cognizant of the strictures of PACE and Section 11.1, the urgent interview provisions of PACE, and we'd prepared a script for them. So in the event of these officers followed the surveillance team, and in the event of that arrest having to be ordered, they were already briefed to conduct an urgent interview under PACE conditions, to this extent that he was cautioned a second time and the interview was recorded.
Here's where we start to uncover just why this case is so unusual. The PACE codes are very detailed, running to hundreds of pages of guidance that all police officers are meant to observe, covering all aspects of conduct around arrests, interviews, surveillance, video and audio recordings, and every other eventuality. When Steve talks about the exceptions to the rule, he's talking Section 11.1, just a couple of lines in the whole document, but critical to this case. So there's total clarity here. I'm just going to quote from it directly. Following a decision to arrest a suspect, they must not be interviewed about the relevant offence except at a police station or other authorised place of detention, unless the consequent delay would be likely to lead to interference with or harm to evidence connected with an offence, interference with or physical harm to other people, or serious loss of or damage to property. So, if an officer thinks that any of those apply, they can proceed with what's known as an urgent interview. Basically, an interview with no solicitor and outside of an authorised place of detention. As far as Steve was concerned, the circumstances justified this approach.
So I'd pre-planned an urgent interview to be instituted at point of arrest. This is part of the provisions of the Police and Criminal Evidence Act under Section 11.1, which, where there's an immediate threat to life, it is perfectly legitimate for officers to interview parties on the ground without reference to solicitors or return to the police station. All done under caution, and in this case, to a pre-thought-through script. So the principal question was, is Sian still alive? Will you tell us where Sian is? And that's essentially the nub of that interview.
There's actually a transcript of all this. Here's how it goes, taken from Steve's book. The arresting officer cautioned Halliwell with the words, "You do not have to say anything, but it may harm your defence if you don't mention, when questioned, something which you later rely on in court. Anything you do say may be given in evidence." Dex Drummond, the other officer involved, then says, The focus of the investigation is to find Sian O'Callaghan. Tell me where Sian is. Halliwell says, I don't know. To which Dex responds, can you help us with where Sian is? Halliwell, I don't know where she is. I don't think I should say any more without speaking to a solicitor. Dex responds with a question. Do you know if Sian is safe? To which Halliwell simply says, no comment. After that, Dex tries once more. Can you help us in finding out if Sian is safe? And Halliwell says, no comment. Not until I speak to a solicitor. Can I go to the police station now? This exchange obviously was not what Steve was hoping for. It left him staring down the barrel of a pretty unenviable dilemma.
So I was in the command point at Cable Cross Police Station, and I've got officers on the ground, a surveillance commander, who is feeding me back information on what is occurring and what Halliwell is saying. That's the information I was after from the interview team. And when I received the information that they'd gone through the script that I'd prepared with my interview advisor the night before, and he'd offered no comment, I then have the critical decision.
And this is where I have to think quickly and on my feet. What options are left to me? If he comes into custody, Sian O'Callaghan, you have to accept, will die, and if she's already dead, will never be found. Because there's no mechanism for him to give an account in interview with a solicitor who's exercising his responsibility to prevent him incriminating himself, given that he's already been given the opportunity to answer those two simple questions. Is she still alive? Where is she? And he's declined to do so.
This is where the case starts to become contested. When you ask critics of Steve Fulcher where he went wrong, his harshest ones will say it's around this point. They'll say he should have brought Halliwell in and begun the normal process. He's had his urgent interview, and Halliwell has offered no comment. But Steve doesn't see it that way. He didn't then, and he doesn't now.
Her life is my responsibility. I took the view that the best way for me to fulfill my responsibility to Sian O'Callaghan was to intervene myself. And all I could do was plead with him for her life. It's the least I could do for her, and it's the least I could do for Elaine and the rest of the family. So I directed the officers who were transporting Halliwell to go to the place I considered most likely Sian to be, and that was Barbary Castle, and I'd meet them there. So I left the police station and went straight to Barbary Castle.
Based on the telephony, Steve had guessed Barbary Castle, just outside Swindon, was the place Sian was most likely to be. To journalist Steve Brody, reporting every twist of the story, this was an unexpected turn of events.
His officers have arrested Halliwell. Steve Fulcher then takes this very, very unusual decision to leave the incident room and drive out to where his officers are holding Christopher Halliwell. That in itself is pretty unusual. Detective superintendents don't usually run around. They have other officers to do that, and that's right and proper. He takes the decision to go out. He tells his officers to drive Christopher Halliwell to a place called Barbary Castle, which is a very nice, popular beauty spot outside Swindon. Almost unprecedented, almost unprecedented. But of course, that's the first situation where it could be argued he's gone wrong. But Halliwell is arrested under suspicion of kidnap. Now, that allows Steve Fulcher to have what is called an urgent extended interview. Legally, he can do that because He's arrested on suspicion of kidnapped.
Journalist Rob Murphy saw it as a fairly unorthodox move.
When detectives arrested Halliwell, it was two arresting officers that did it in the supermarket. It wasn't Steve Fulcher. He was across town in the inquiry room. And he was desperate for information. He'd been awake all night. He was desperate to know what was going on. Was he talking? Was he admitting? Was he confessing? And the answer that came through from the arresting officers was no. Chris Halliwell was saying no comment. He wanted a solicitor. He wanted to go to a police station. He wanted to be read his rights properly. So it was at that point, it was at that juncture, that Steve Fulcher decided to take an extraordinary gamble. He decided that he wouldn't give Halliwell his rights like that, but he would extend this urgent interview, this highly unorthodox urgent interview, and he would go out to meet him at Barbary Castle, man to man, one to one, and to plead with his conscience.
For Steve Fulcher, if it came down to a choice between Sian's life and pushing the boundaries of the PACE laws, there was never any question about which he would choose.
It's extreme because there is a simple standard police procedure, which is somebody's under arrest, they're taken into custody. In major crime cases, they're given a solicitor, but in major crime cases, they offer no comment, and you either have the evidence or you don't. The difference in this case, of course, is it isn't a reactive murder investigation. It's a crime in action, it's a kidnap, and a girl's life is at stake. And that was the equation I was working on. And that is the justification for using Section 111, the urgent interview provisions. So I've had officers who have interviewed him. They've asked him, is Sian still alive? Will you tell us where she is? No comment. I'm the SIO. I'm the party that's responsible. I'm going to ask him the same questions because the consequences of the failure to do that sit entirely on my shoulders. If Sian was alive and could have been saved and I didn't take this measure, who's going to put their arm around my shoulder and say, well, at least you didn't breach Code C of PACE? Utter nonsense. So it's my decision, and I met him on the hill at Barbary Castle.
A matter of minutes later, Steve was to meet the man he had so relentlessly pursued for the last 5 days. It was a meeting that would have a huge ripple effect. As you might expect, it is a day Steve remembers vividly. What were his first impressions of Halliwell?
I had no idea what I'd find. Obviously, I'd seen pictures of him. I'd had all this information relayed to me. He's got very deep set, very distinctive eyes, sallow complexion, very thin face, very drawn in. He's clearly a sort of chain smoker, and that sort of sallow complexion sort of bears that out. Anybody that's been arrested under those circumstances, you'd expect to be affected by it. I'd remembered what the officers had said regarding his demeanour when they'd approached him the previous day for the DNA swabs. Very nervous. But I could only assess it firsthand by speaking to him. What am I going to find?
Steve was also conscious that Halliwell wasn't the only one on edge when the two finally met at Barbary Castle. Unlike the name suggests, Barbary Castle is not actually a castle. It is the remains of an Iron Age fort set into the hills of Wiltshire. From the air, the site looks more like a football field. The field is surrounded by two circular boundaries, which were once defensive ramparts. In this remote and secluded space, the two men faced each other. There was so much at stake for both of them.
It was intense. I mean, you've got to bear in mind, I was conscious throughout of the pressure that both Christopher and I had been through ever since Saturday night. We were both on a knife edge. He knew that if he held the line, he'd get away with it. He didn't quite know what I knew. I suppose that's the point. But my view was this was the only opportunity to find Sian, and if at such point as I gave up on it, that was the end of Sian's life. We'd never, as it turns out, we'd never find her. You have to bear in mind, I didn't know definitively and I'd always kept an open mind as to whether or not he was responsible for Sian's abduction. I formed the opinion very quickly, having sort of locked eyes with him, that in all probability he was, and because all the evidence from the surveillance crew supported that view. So then it became an issue of, if you have abducted Sian and you've decided not to reveal her location, you will necessarily cause her death. My responsibility is to Sian, and I have to find that location, otherwise she will die. So that was the equation I was coming from. From his point of view, and I can see it entirely, if I keep silent, these officers are probably fishing in the dark.
What happened next is again a matter of record, because Debbie Peach was at Steve's side to transcribe what was said. What she wrote in the next few minutes would be the basis of painstaking courtroom scrutiny for years to come.
Deborah Peach came with me to Barbary Castle because she, as any scribe, follows on your shoulder wherever you go, because the important thing is to record everything that is said and done, and so that I can demonstrate my transparency in my decision-making and the rationale for that to any subsequent court. So the notion that I was doing anything underhand is simply not true. I mean, I had a scribe there expressly to ensure that everything was recorded and could be put in front of a court for their consideration, which is exactly what happened.
Here's how things went according to the transcript in Steve's book. Steve: I'm Steve Fulcher. I'm running this inquiry and I'm looking for Sian O'Callaghan. I'd like you to get out of the car and come with me. They walk a few yards away from the police car. Steve: Are you going to tell me where Sian is? Halliwell: I don't know anything. Steve: Are you going to tell me where Sian is? What's going to happen is that if you tell us where Sian is, that whatever you will be portrayed as, you would have done the right thing. Halliwell: I want to go to the station. Steve: If you're innocent, just tell me. Tell me and I'll take the inquiry from there. Are you prepared to tell me where Sian is? Halliwell: You think I did it? Steve: I know you did it. Halliwell: Can I go to the station? Steve: You can go to the station. What will happen is that you will be vilified in the press. Do you remember the Joanna Yates murder and Christopher Jeffries? He was all over the papers. If you tell me where Sian is, they will know you helped me. You would have done the right thing. Halliwell: I want to speak to a solicitor. Steve: You are being given an opportunity to tell me where Sian is. In 1 hour's time, you will be in the press. Halliwell: I want to speak to a solicitor. Steve: You will speak to a solicitor. I'm giving you an opportunity to tell me where Sian is. By the end of this cycle, you will be vilified. Tell me where Sian is. Halliwell: Have you got a car? We'll go. There are a few specific things we need to pause on here. First, there's the reference to Joanna Yates and Christopher Jeffries. This comes up again later in the story. A few months prior to Sian's abduction, a young woman called Joanna Yates had gone missing from her flat in Bristol and been found murdered. Chris Jeffries lived in another flat in the same building and was initially arrested by police on suspicion of the murder. This prompted a number of newspapers to vilify him extensively in their reportage before he was released without charge, and the actual perpetrator, another man who also lived in the same block of flats, was arrested and charged.
He was obviously determined to make no comment and continue the same line. I know my rights. I want my solicitor. I'm not saying anything. I'm not confirming whether Shan is alive or dead. I'm not doing anything to help you find Shan. That was his determination. Where I was criticised was as a gambit to get him to understand the position. I explained the consistency with the Christopher Jeffries case in Joanna Yates's case, that if he's innocent and if he's dropped her off at a particular point as a taxi driver, tell me and I'll move the inquiry there. And the point I made was, look, we've got the whole media outside the police station. You're going to be taken into custody. They'll be doing a number on you as they did to Christopher Jeffries. And if you're innocent, simply tell me and you don't need that to happen. Now, that was twisted to suggest that I threatened to vilify him in the press, as if I could do such a thing, for one thing, i.e. as if I could get the media to vilify somebody against their interest. It just, I'm not sure that's even workable, but that wasn't the threat, and it's simply misrepresented. There was no oppression. You cannot oppress somebody in these terms to give you information, as he did over the course of 4 hours, that I had no knowledge of myself. What I was saying was, you will be vilified in the press, not I will vilify you in the press. The media will vilify you in the press in the same way they did Christopher Jeffries. The point being that if you're innocent, you don't want that to happen. Regardless of whether you're guilty or innocent, you'll be pilloried in the media. There's a massive difference there in terms of what I was saying. And the frustration throughout the 6 years is that the one witness to this conversation, the person that recorded the notes, Debbie Peach, her account has never been taken.
The other thing that leaps out at me reading this is Halliwell is very clear that he wants to see a solicitor.
And I told him he will have a solicitor. You will have a solicitor. But this is your opportunity to do the right thing and tell us where Shan is. You can see the logic of this issue. If he's not going to tell me under these circumstances such that we can find Shan and save her life, he's not going to do the same with the solicitor. Why would he? Because the issue is the same. Either you want us to find this girl or you don't. But as far as that final conversation was concerned, I had nowhere else to go. So he was going to go back into the police station. That was the end of Shan O'Callaghan's life, if that happened, because there is no mechanism for getting that information out of a police interview. For whatever your tame lawyers might say, there isn't, because to do so would require him to incriminate himself on the basis of zero evidence. Why would you do that?
For Steve, there was so much more at stake than Halliwell's repeated requests for a solicitor, especially when they were standing at the very place Steve believed he had taken Shan to.
Because I didn't know where Shan was. I'd have assumed she was somewhere at Barbary Castle. So the information was all under his control. But he came to a point where, because of my refusal to back down, refusal to throw in the towel and say, OK, I'll accept the death of Shan O'Callaghan on my conscience for the rest of my life, because you're exercising your right to kill her through your silence. Because I refused to accept that, he reached the point at which his ability to constrain himself and maintain the line of silence was no longer sustainable.
In the end, it all came down to a couple of seconds.
If he'd held out for another 15 seconds, then we'd have taken him back to the car. My life would have been a lot easier. He'd have walked free because there was no evidence that would justify a charge in this case. And he'd have succeeded in getting away with them. He never obviously rolled over. What he said was, have you got a car? We'll go. So even at that point, I didn't know. I thought it was an acceptance on his part that he was going to take me to Shan, but it wasn't explicit, and it was never explicit actually throughout the entire journey. So we were entirely in his hands as to whether or not he had a change of heart, asked us to turn the car around, go back to the police station, or whatever he wanted to do.
Steve felt a shift in Halliwell.
He Because when we're interviewing people, we look for those buy signs, that idea that they've turned from an implacable opposition to answering or telling the truth to a glimmer of hope that actually the truth may come. It wasn't enough of a statement to be definitive, but it was enough for me to work on that glimmer of hope that in fact he was going to do the right thing and take me to her.
It seemed that Halliwell had just offered to take Steve and his team to Sian O'Callaghan, who they had been looking for non-stop for almost a week. Steve could hardly believe his luck. Now he just had to hold the moment and pray that Halliwell wasn't going to lead him up the garden path. On the next episode of The Detective's Dilemma.
He said, you and I should have a chat.
What's the point of appointing a policeman with tremendous ability if you don't use that ability?
They've clearly never been in a position of trying to get a cough out of a serial killer.